Should I say pants in Morse code for Chris's benefit? Is that a challenge right there? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. There you go. For anyone who ever hears this, that was pants in Morse code.
That was a pants check in Morse code.
This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 73 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, Mike Morrison. Today, we will be discussing the philosophical themes and issues in the second season episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, Pen Pals. And Mike, you and I were talking before the show that this is probably the first episode of Metatrex where we picked the title of the show before we actually recorded the show.
I know, and we've had this actually on the docket for quite a while. We'd planned this out way back. We were somewhere in the 50s, I think, at the time when we decided to put this particular episode in the lineup. So I'm looking forward to it. But Zachary, there's this strange tapping noise. What is that tapping in the background?
It could be my Morse code key. And for those of you that don't know, and some of you might know this already, but I am a ham radio operator. In the side. I have been for a long time. I got my first ham radio license when I was 13 in 1991. That's a long time ago now. Back when, right about, you know, shortly after when this episode of TNG aired, actually, is when I got my ham radio license. For those of you that don't know this, the number 73 has a special meaning in Morse code on ham radio. It's used as a way of saying goodbye. It literally means best wishes in Morse code. So when you're signing off with someone, you send them 73 in Morse code. And it sounds something like this. Da 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 da. That is 73 in Morse code. So some time ago, we were talking about what we were going to do for episode 73, and I had this crazy idea. Let's do an episode on space ham radio. And the episode that came to mind was the second season TNG episode Pen Pals. And that is the episode where Data, if you remember, starts talking over his space ham radio to a girl on a dying planet, and he has to decide whether to help save the girl and this planet from destruction. All by space ham radio.
And that's a great episode from the second season. And we know it's second season because Diana Muldaur is in some of these great conversations in the dialogue of this episode. And there really is. This episode is so rich with great dialogue. As far as the writing is concerned, it's one of my favorite episodes from that second season. There's so many quotable lines, and some of those lines, you and I were talking in the turbo lift, are very indicative of not just great Star Trek, but they really sum up the Next Generation. For instance, the quote, "The dilemma exists, we have to discuss the options." I mean, that just sums it up right there. We're going to have a board meeting. We're going to do a Geordi PowerPoint. And
I think you're right. This is Star Trek The Next Generation in a nutshell. Whenever there's a crisis, if this were the original series, it would be like, okay, let's beam down with our phasers. And in The Next Generation, it's like, okay, there's a crisis. We violated the Prime Directive. This world's in danger. Let's have a board meeting.
Yeah, yeah. Another great quote, Zachary, that I'll throw in right here from the beginning is actually a Data quote. And The thing that I love about this episode is this really brings the problems of a world into our space. So many times we see suffering, and I'm talking about in our own world, we're going to pull out of the Star Trek universe for a moment. We flip on the television, or we fire up our computers, or we get on our smartphones, however it is that we get our news and information. There's so many ways to do that these days. When we fire these things up and we look at the news, it's easy to browse through and we see all kinds of things going on in the world, and we see things going on in Hollywood, and we see things going on in politics, and oh, look, you know, another missile's been fired in Korea or whatever. And it's easy to kind of discard those things as not being relevant. But Data reminds us in this episode that oftentimes these things involve people. He says the Dreamans are not subject for philosophical debate. They are a people. And my goodness, is that ever something that we need to remember here today in 2017?
I think one of the things I love about this episode right off the bat is the way in which it really demonstrates the power of a starship captain to determine the fate of an entire world. You don't see the stakes being quite so high this often in Star Trek. Oftentimes it's political disputes. Do we get involved or do we not get involved? We know there are consequences, but they're not like the entire planet and the entire species is going to be wiped out kind of situations. We do see it a couple times in Star Trek The Next Generation, but this is one of the couple times and maybe the first time where we see that the stakes can be really, really high when you're sitting in the center chair.
Yeah, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. And the whole episode kind of surrounds this idea of this, you know, cry from the dark, as they kind of refer to it. And it's a radio conversation going on between Data and a small child from this doomed planet. And it's fascinating because, again, Zachary, and you can speak to this much, much more than I can. I remember the old school days back before you were even born. My father was into that whole CB thing in the early 70s. And, he had this incredible linear CB. The thing must cost hundreds of dollars in 1970, which would probably be thousands of dollars today. And he talked to people all over the country and even in some places outside the U.S. on that thing. And it was a big deal. He had a handle and, the 10-4 good buddy. That to me always seemed interesting. And even when I grew up, this idea of mass communication, and you and I both have some roots in the Radio Shack thing. And that was always fun for me, is this whole idea of communication. And that was really where I excelled in selling in the electronics world, was, cell phones and computers in the days of the internet. So I find this fascinating as well.
You know, there's so much here that I find really interesting and relevant to me personally. I got my ham radio license when I was about 13, and my dad and my grandmother got their ham radio licenses at the same time, about 1962, 55 years ago now. That's hard to believe.
That's incredible.
And I actually have one of their original ham radios. It's a beast of a vacuum tube-laden machine. It glows in the dark. It's heavy. It's a monster. It's amazing how much technology has actually changed. And I think we forget, especially people who are younger that grew up with technology, and you and I grew up with technology. Like you said, you came from the 70s with the CB craze going on, and I came from the 80s with computers going on. It's easy to forget how magical technology really is. Back in the day, it was really amazing and novel to be able to communicate without wires over a distance. Think of all the, you and I are talking right now. I'm in California, you're in Texas, and we are talking over what are essentially wires, maybe through satellites. I'm not sure how our signals are being routed, but there's a lot of infrastructure in place to be able for us to have a conversation. And I think the magical thing for me about ham radio was always being able to talk directly to someone else, either using voice or Morse code or some sort of data transmission, but with no wires. Essentially being wireless, right? It's magical. It's like action at a distance in some sort of spooky, mystical sense. And it's really interesting. And I can totally relate to Data, like sitting in his quarters, getting this strange signal from you know, someone he's never met before. I can't tell you the number of nights in my lifetime I've spent, you know, in the dark with the ham radio glowing, you know, sending out a CQ and Morse code, or, you know, trying to contact someone I haven't talked to before. And I've talked to people all around the world with no infrastructure. And it's magical, because when you basically get on the ham radio and you do what Sarchenka did in this episode, which is say, is anybody out there? And in ham radio, you do that with the signal CQ. You can say CQ, CQ, this is, then you say your call sign. So Data's like calling CQ, 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 is anyone out there? And Sarchenka goes, I'm here. Is anybody out there? and they have a conversation, and it's magical. And you can really build real friendships. I have people I've known my entire life now that I'm friends with because of that kind of connection. In fact, just a couple years ago, I met someone that I first met when I was probably 13 on the ham radio. He just lives a few towns away, and we'd never met in real life. And when I finally moved back to the area, we actually met in person. It was amazing.
That's
so
awesome.
It's really interesting. And so I just find the whole thing magical and interesting. And it's interesting that to me that we've kind of forgotten how amazing it is that we can do this kind of thing, this kind of communication at a distance in the first place. And in the 24th century, I can only imagine how much more that must be the case. Just take for granted that you can talk to people anywhere, anytime. To me, that kind of raises an interesting question about the status of this kind of thing in the 24th century. I think that whenever communication exists, people are naturally social. They're going to want to find a way to talk to other people. Oftentimes people they haven't met before, they do want friends. And Captain Picard rightly points out that there's a loneliness in Sarchenka's call to Data, right? Is anybody out there? And I think human nature is just such that we do seek out friendships. And if you don't, you know, if you're not keeping yourself busy in real life, you seek out friendships online or over radio or whatever. And that's just human nature. I can't imagine a 24th century where something like a future version of ham radio doesn't exist, where people sit there with their little subspace radios and call out, is anybody out there, and see who they can talk to.
I think it's the simplicity of it that really attracts me. You know, as I've gotten older, I'm becoming a little bit more nostalgic, and I've really considered going out and buying just a small CB, just a cheap CB, and setting up and playing around with it just to kind of bring back the feeling that I had. I mean, Zachary, I was a very small boy. In fact, if I shared my handle, it'd probably tell you how small I was. But those are the memories of...
Tell me your handle was Mike the Kickboxer.
No, it was Diaper Boy.
Diaper Boy. So I think
but rather those than... are my earliest memories. I mean, I have those memories of sitting there with my dad while he was on his, you know, his beautiful shiny silver linear CB, you know, talking to truckers passing through and friends, you know, two towns over and whatnot. It just... Those are good memories, and just the magic of communication and being able to hold a conversation. We take it for granted now, but you know, you and I have this conversation just about every week. You know, we get here on our Zoom call. I can see you. You can see me. In reality, we've never met in person, but you know, we're able to communicate. We have cell phones. We literally communicate everywhere now.
One of the coolest things I ever did with the ham radio, I built my own little low power radio, kind of like Sarchenka. She had her little, I want to take my transmitter with me wherever I go. I can't leave without my transmitter. So I built my little 5-watt transmitter, which is nothing. Like with ham radio, you're allowed to use 1500 watts. And this was a little 5-watt transmitter. I used that and I strung up a little wire antenna, long wire antenna. It's a shortwave antenna around my apartment when I was still living in an apartment. And I talked to someone in Australia. Using 5 watts, using a little tiny radio that I built myself with a wire strung around my apartment. And that was so cool. And if that doesn't sound cool, you're not one of my people.
That sounds very cool.
It was lots of fun. Yeah, I guess my point is just there's a challenge to it. It's like, you know, it's too easy to jump on the internet and have a conversation. It's cooler if you sort of raise the stakes and go, well, I'm going to try to build my own radio and use this crappy little wire antenna. I'm going to put that around my apartment and see if I can talk to Australia. And, you know, there's a sense of accomplishment there, even though, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really matter. Just pleased I was able to make it work.
Well, one of the takeaways from this episode of TNG, at least for me, is this idea that with the advanced power of a starship, it was still something as simple as communication that saved a planet.
And it wasn't even subspace. It was old-fashioned RF, if I remember the episode correctly.
Old-fashioned RF, yes. Yes. So that's one of the big takeaways. And I think that's a truth that it's easy to forget in 2017, where we literally carry our smartphones around in our pockets. You know, I'm a little bit older. I first started selling electronics for Radio Shack back when cell phones came in bags and were still bolted in cars that required antennas mounted on the vehicle in order to operate. So I've literally seen this communication industry evolve, you know, over the past, you know, 25 years or so. It just seems to me that it's easy to forget how essential communication is and how simple it can really be.
I think what we don't see anymore, people are generally not used to this being a thing. We don't get whispers in the dark anymore. You don't spend a lot of time talking to strangers, and you don't spend a lot of time without the infrastructure, right? And when you're on the ham radio, especially back in the day, I'm thinking like back when my dad and grandmother were doing ham radio back in the 60s, right? And you might have to get on the phone and call the authorities and go, there's a ship in distress and here's their coordinates out in the middle of the ocean. And being able to play an active role in lending aid to others when you don't know the people and you just got to whisper in the dark from them over the ham radio. That was a real thing, you know, until fairly recently. Now with all the interconnectedness and the infrastructure, those kinds of things are automated. Individuals don't have to play that active role in deciding, do I help or not? I can totally picture myself back when I first got my ham radio license sitting there tuning my shortwave radio, sending a Morse code and hearing an SOS. Like, whoa, okay, what if I got an SOS on my ham radio, mm-hmm. on Morse code? What would I do? Would I ignore it? That's essentially the dilemma that the crew of the Enterprise faces in this episode. Do I help or do I not help? Because they don't have to help. They can just, you know, aim the ship a different direction and keep on going, right?
Yes.
I mean, Data's already communicated with Sarshenka, so it's not quite as simple as just ignoring it. But Captain Picard essentially tells him, cease all communication, and we're going to change directions, and we're not going to intervene. And that's how the episode kind of starts. And that's a real thing, right? If you get an actual distress call, an SOS, or a message in a bottle, if you're listening to a police song, then you have to decide, do I help or do I not help? And you have to weigh the consequence. Like, if I decide to help, then I'm going to be placed in this difficult position where I've got to decide, how do I help? And I might have to intermediate. And it might be really difficult. I might have to deal with it. And if you ignore it, you have it on your conscience. Like, I could have let a bunch of people on a boat somewhere die, right? And that was a real dilemma that people had to face. And every time you get on the radio, you run that possibility that you could get, you know, someone in a boat, someone in an airplane, someone in a car, someone wherever, you know, stranded somewhere, and you might have to intervene. And being that kind of a good Samaritan, whenever someone is in need of aid, to render the aid and get people communicating to make the situation okay. That's part, I think, of the responsibility of having those kinds of communication tools at your disposal.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up kind of the conundrum that exists within this episode, because it's more than just an episode about communication. It's an episode about a problem, a real problem that exists that needs dealt with. Data has had ongoing communications with, you know, this girl, and he's aware of the situation, and he's kind of set aside the prime directive in doing so. So that opens up a whole other can of worms. And so in the boardroom of the Enterprise D, we have a debate going on. Do we help or do we not help? But in the midst of all of that, we have kind of a coming of age story about young Wesley Crusher and his first steps into a bold new world of being a Starfleet officer.
Actually, Mike, I think if memory serves, that Captain Picard's quarters serve as the Enterprise D boardroom in this episode.
Yes, I think you're actually right.
For some reason, I never really understood. Like, let's all meet in my quarters, clandestine-like. Secret meeting in the captain's quarters.
Well, they were dealing with sensitive prime directive issues that could have probably led to somebody's court.
Well, commercial. It gets a little crowded there in the ready room, so we needed a little more room. But seriously, this is actually, for me, what makes this episode worthwhile philosophically, because in the middle of, it's a very talky episode, even though the stakes are really high. There's this planet whose existence is in jeopardy and danger. The conversation that happens in Picard's quarters is an extremely talky episode. The conversation that happens in Picard's quarters is an extremely talky conversation, right? They're all sitting around essentially a song circle, and each character gets to say his or her piece about what the prime directive means and what our responsibilities are, weighing how strictly to interpret the Prime Directive or how loosely to interpret the Prime Directive, weighing consequences versus responsibility to other rules, weighing principles versus relationships and emotional import for Data and his friendship with this person he's just met. And it's an extremely complicated philosophical discussion that happens in 2 minutes. It's a lot to pack into a 2-minute conversation inside Captain Picard's quarters. So I do want to give a shout out to the individuals that made this episode happen, because I think the writing is so philosophically interesting and really condensed, right? It takes what could be a very long, drawn-out conversation and condenses it to its core essence, and that's what we see inside this scene in Captain Picard's quarters. So the story credit goes to Hannah Louise Shearer, and the story was brought to life in screenplay form by our friend of the network, Melinda Snodgrass. So for me, I'm really just fundamentally impressed at the complexity of the philosophical dialogue that happens in such a brief amount of time inside this episode.
So the story of this episode was pitched by, of course, Anne Louise Shearer. And one of the producers was instantly fond of the premise. It was Maurice Hurley. He called it his second favorite premise of the series after The Last Outpost. He remarked, this is Maurice Hurley.
Okay.
Somebody's out there, some little kid on some little planet sending out a CQ, just like I did in my bedroom when I was 10 years old with my little crystal sets. Sending out CQs and never getting it back. But here somebody says, anybody out there? And a voice replies, yes, wait a minute.
I'm actually a little disappointed that an android never replied to my CQs. That would have been a heck of a lot more interesting. Actually, you know, it got me thinking. At the end of this episode, you know, they wipe Sarshenka's memory of the situation. And it's kind of like ancient aliens visited this planet. Do you think that in thousands of years, in a future Drama 4, there'll be these stories of ancient aliens or ancient androids visiting their planet and saving their world? Just like we have stories of ancient aliens visiting the Egyptians nowadays. Data is the ancient alien. Think about that for a minute. There's going to be this massive conspiracy theory on Drama 4.
That's only if the memory wipe doesn't last.
Well, they must have left some sort of evidence, right? A tricorder, a communicator, a hypo spray. You know, some sort of implant in Sarshenka's brain. You know, Pulaski. Oh, dropped an implant in there. Oh, we'll just sew that sucker up. No problem.
All she remembers are those yellow eyes. Those beady yellow eyes.
Lidless and wreathed in flames. Oh, wait, wrong franchise.
Yeah, you and I were talking again in the Turbolift about just how well-written this episode of The Next Generation is. And I have to say, when I think about The Next Generation, these are the types of episodes that I think about, because they are talky episodes. They're wordy. They're philosophical debates. They're explorations, and we're not firing phasers. We're not squaring off against the Romulans. We're not having some kind of strain that involves Klingons. We're dealing with a problem, and we're coming up with solutions. We're working together as a team, and we're solving them. And for that matter, in the midst of this episode, one of the things I think that really sets the tone for not just Captain Picard, but the entire crew throughout the rest of The Next Generation is the way that they're able to put their humanitarian obligations ahead of their own duty. In fact, Captain Picard says as much in the episode when he's talking to Data. He says to Data, "You reminded us that there are obligations that go beyond duty." And I love the way that Data is used to be this kind of voice of reason, this, you know, this android who is going to really transcend his own programming and really in many ways defy the Prime Directive in order to do what is right ethically for the Dreemans.
It is a very Star Trek The Next Generation irony that it's Commander Data who is often pointing out the humanity of the situation, right? Everyone else, you know, even though they've all taken the same oaths and they're human beings and they all have, you know, essentially the same responsibilities, it's Data who comes along and says that the Draymans are people, not a subject of philosophical debate, right? The tendency is to abstract the reality of the situation away when you're having philosophical discussions. And that's essentially what's going on. We have this incredibly high-level, abstract, depersonified philosophical and ethical discussion inside Captain Picard's quarters, and it's Data who has to come along and say, "But these are people, darn it!" He doesn't say "darn it," but if "darn it" was in Data's vocabulary, he would say "darn it."
Yeah, and I have to say too that this is an episode that really changed my whole opinion of Dr. Pulaski in this episode. When she first comes into season two, I got to be honest, in those early episodes of season two, I am not a fan of Dr. Pulaski. I mean, Diana Muldaur is a wonderful actress, and I have been a fan and appreciate so much of what she brings to so many of the roles that she's had over the years. But this particular role, I just didn't care for her early on. I'm just going to say I didn't care for her early on. But somewhere about midway through the season, and as we get, this is the 15th episode of season two, we're starting to get a softer, more even-tempered Dr. Pulaski. And really, in many ways, we see a whole different side of her. She's so cut and dry in so many ways, but she really kind of bucks the system in this episode and really goes to bat to try to do the right thing for the Dreemans who are facing extinction.
Well, she's analogous to Dr. McCoy from the original Star Trek, right? Yes. Rough around the edges, but also the voice of compassion and humanity.
Yes.
So speaking of the conversation that happens in Captain Picard's ready room, what do we think of the individual positions that the various participants in the dialogue take? I think we should run down these one at a time and just give our two cents on each person's take on the situation.
Yeah, let's do that.
Worf actually starts the dialogue, and I think this is really interesting. Worf, with his, you know, Klingon mannerisms, his arms crossed, standing extremely tall, says, "There are no options. The Prime Directive is not a matter of degrees. It is an absolute." So, Worf essentially takes the Kantian position that rules are rules, and even if we don't like the consequences, we stick to the rules.
And that's quintessential Commander Worf, isn't it? We expect as much from him. He is rigid, and I think that Michael Dorn plays this so well, and I've got that image of him standing there with his arms folded in my mind. I can remember that scene so vividly. And I honestly have to admit something. I haven't watched this episode in probably a year. It's been about a year since I did my last Next Generation rewatch. So it's been a little while. But I have that vision of him in that gold uniform with his arms folded, his chin stuck out. He's going to stick to the rules. He's going to do it by the book. And that's just the way it is.
See, now I'm kind of picturing Immanuel Kant himself standing there in the lecture hall in Königsberg saying to his ethics students, "There are no options. Ethical principles are not a matter of degree. They are absolutes." Do you think he had the same kind of delivery that Michael Dorn has? It might have been more effective. But Pulaski immediately chimes in and says, speaking of Pulaski, she immediately chimes in and says, "I have a problem with that kind of rigidity. It seems callous and cowardly." She calls Worf a coward.
Yeah, and if she were any other man, he'd kill her where she stands.
But it does seem callous because essentially if you take that position, the Kantian position that rules are absolutes, sometimes that's going to lead to consequences that an emotional person would find unacceptable and callous. And at the end of the day, if Kant is right in his ethical theory about sticking to the rule, and it's not clear what Kant would say about the situation. We're not saying Kant would say, "Let all the people die." In fact, he might say the exact opposite. But that kind of reasoning, this absolute reasoning, is eventually going to lead to consequences that you're not happy with. And you have to be able to go, "Yes, but we followed the rules and that was the right thing to do. Consequences be damned."
And what an honest debate, because in reality, that is what happens sometimes. We oftentimes quote the rules in order to escape our obligations, our sense of humanity. We use it as a means to get out of doing the hard things sometimes. And in so saying that, I can remember, you know, from that famous speech where President Kennedy stood and he said, "We're going to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they're easy, but because they're hard." In an age where we were getting all kinds of excuses for why we couldn't get into the space race and really make an impact and get a man to the moon. You know, Kennedy stood up and said, "Hey, we're going to do the hard things because they're hard." And in these types of situations where you have a problem, and clearly there's a problem here in this episode, that the dilemma exists, they said in that discussion. And we have to discuss options. It's so easy to use that rule book to say we don't have a dilemma and we can just, you know, the rules say that we have to do A, B, and C, and that's what we're going to do, and we're not going to deal with it. But in reality, Zachary, real life doesn't work like that. Oftentimes, there are consequences to inactions. Not to act is to act, according to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a pastor and a spy during World War II in Germany.
So we see that Pulaski has introduced this compassion into the discussion, but Picard has a really interesting reply to Pulaski. He kind of takes this interesting hypothetical philosophical approach to the discussion, invoking something like determinism. He says, well, if we could predict all the possible outcomes of the situation, then we might be able to decide what the right thing to do is. It reminds me a lot of causal determinism in philosophy. Like, he's basically taking the position of the philosopher Laplace, who said, well, if we could know everything about everything, all the particles and their trajectories, we should be able to predict the future, in which case we'd know exactly what we should do, right? I don't find this terribly convincing, and no one else in the room seems to either. And even Captain Picard kind of says, well, okay, you know, if we could know everything, then this wouldn't be a dilemma. But obviously we don't know everything, so it is a real dilemma. But he kind of takes this deterministic approach. Well, if we could predict the future, then we would know what to do. And I just find that a terribly, insofar as this is a great discussion, this is actually one of the weak points of the discussion, I think. Captain Picard should know better than invoking determinism in this way to try to reason his way out of an ethical dilemma.
Yeah, and a fascinating thing, and not to get ahead of ourselves in the conversation we're discussing, this conversation between the senior staff of the Enterprise, but you know, Troy says, you know, aren't we part of the cosmic plan? And it's easy to dismiss one's free will in the midst of such a difficult debate, but in reality, it seems like a moot point to me to try and invoke determinism when you're discussing personal agency and actions of personal agency in order to affect change.
Well, Riker pretty much says, well, that pretty much does it in for fate then, right? If it ultimately rests on our response to that anyway, or our presence in the grand scheme of things and what we decide to do, then the whole idea of fate goes out the window anyway. And so that's a really interesting point, that the second you invoke fate, as Troy says, you can say, well, there's a cosmic plan, and then we're either part of that cosmic plan or we're not a part of that cosmic plan. And if we're fated to be part of that cosmic plan and to act, and it's ultimately on our shoulders anyway, then what's the point of invoking fate in the first place? Riker does a great job of pointing out why that's inconsistent.
Yes, yes. I'm surprised he didn't say, well, frankly, I feel fated to warp to Risa.
Yeah, I think this episode really does illustrate that kind of reasoning. If you say, well, we've got an ethical dilemma, let's talk about fate. Let's talk about, you know, a divine plan, or let's talk about, the causal determinism, like Captain Picard does, that those kinds of things don't get you off the hook for the ethical dilemma. You know, we know this, religious people do this a lot of the times. They will go, it's God's plan that blah, 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 blah. And you go, well, are you part of that plan, or are you not part of the plan? It's still on your shoulders, buddy. Invoking God's plan doesn't get you off the hook in terms of what you're going to do in this situation here and now.
Exactly, exactly. And Riker says, it's the height of hubris to think that we can or should interfere in the cosmic plan. And in reality, the fact that they're even having this conversation, this discussion, and trying to determine what their reaction to that plan is in and of itself interference. So I think we could throw that argument right out the door.
I think that the kernel of a good idea here from Riker is that we shouldn't go around the universe playing God, right? Captain Picard essentially wields the fate of this entire planet and all the life forms on it in his hands. And he can decide, do these people live or do these people die? So Riker's point is that we should use that power tentatively and cautiously, maybe never, So it's almost better to sit back and let the universe unfold as it should. It's kind of like the Vulcan's position. Let things unfold as they should. Have faith that the universe will unfold as it was meant to, right? Spock makes that point in Star Trek VI. Riker's basically making that position that the universe should unfold as it should, and it's godlike to try to intervene too much in the natural order of things.
But it's just as easy to argue that they are there at that time for a reason. Data got that transmission for a reason.
Because he was meant to, in irony quotes.
And that's essentially what Troy is arguing. She's saying, you know, hey, who's to say that we're not part of that plan? Who's to say that Data didn't get that transmission as part of the plan, or that we're here with a starship and that this power to use as part of the plan?
Well, eventually the conversation circles around to sophistry, that they collectively, I think, realize that what they've started doing is just looking for a reason, justifying taking action, trying to spin the concepts and spin the terms, you know, interpreting her radio call as a cry for help, right? interpreting fate as a way of saying, well, we're here, so we must have been meant to intervene. And this is all sophistry, right? This is all kind of trying to justify what they've essentially already decided upon, that the right thing to do is to help.
And that's basically Picard's conclusion. He says to Data, your whisper from the dark has now become a plea. Suddenly it's something that they're obligated to involve themselves in, or at least they could make it look that way on paper.
Well, they don't reach that conclusion terribly quickly, though, because Picard really does go through this line drawing problem of what kind of situations are we justified in intervening in? Okay, is it okay to violate the rules, violate the prime directive, to intervene when millions of lives are at stake? And Dr. Pulaski chimes in, yes, absolutely. And he says, well, okay, well, in that case, you know, if it's a geological disaster, sure, absolutely. What if it's an epidemic? Oh, well, that's a little different. We're using our medical technology, and that's, you know, a little closer to violating the spirit of the prime directive. What if it's a war? Do we feel justified in intervening to pacify two cultures at war on some planet? Mm-hmm. Same situation. Millions of lives are at stake, right? I think eventually he gets them to see that it's not a pure numbers game, that it's not just the millions of lives at stake, that these situations are, you know, more or less similar to each other. And I think what's interesting is this is a line drawing problem. Like, we're not comfortable saying in Star Trek land, right, with the prime directive, we're not comfortable saying that it's okay to intervene in a war, you know, for the sake of saving millions of lives, because, you know, we don't want to intervene in the natural progression of a world. So that's definitely part of the Star Trek ethos, right? But if millions of lives are at stake because of an ecological disaster, that's a little more okay. And I think Captain Picard just points out that this is a line drawing problem, that these two situations are in fact qualitatively different from each other, but it's not easy to say exactly why they're different from each other. And we need to draw the line somewhere. It's not exactly clear where we should draw the line, but like many line drawing problems, the lack of a precise place to draw the line doesn't mean that there's not a qualitative distinction between the two endpoints on the spectrum that's being highlighted. And here we really have a qualitative difference between, I think, a geological disaster and intervening in a war. Those in prime directive speak, those don't mean the same thing. One is worse from the perspective of the prime directive because it's actively intervening in a culture, changing the culture in some way, right? Whereas preventing death from an ecological disaster is a little more okay from the prime directive standpoint because there's less of a risk of contaminating a culture. And especially at the end of the episode when they decide to wipe Sarshenka's memory, the damage to the culture should be minimal at that point. So I think you can plausibly say that Captain Picard has kind of failed to use the line drawing problem to make the case that we shouldn't intervene in this case.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. And I'm glad you said they didn't get to the answers quickly at all. And that's one of the beauties of this episode. They really, I think, look at each facet of this problem. I mean, they really take their time to map out each of these lines. You talked about this line drawing problem. You know, they really took their time and mapped this whole thing out, and they're exploring the different options. There's a real debate going on. In fact, again, one of my favorite lines, Riker says, "What a perfectly vicious little circle." It is. It's a problem, and it's a problem that circles around. I mean, the minute you think that you have some consensus to go one way or the other in terms of what we're going to do about this, someone raises an argument that causes some doubt. We think about Geordi. You know, Geordi's not willing to let those people die, and he's kind of this voice of reason and you know, there's this kind of humanitarian sort of vibe coming from him, and you got Worf there with his arms folded. It's really a great debate, I think, that is quintessential Star Trek.
Geordi has a great quote. He says, "The Draymans are fated to die. Consider that option considered and rejected." Like, he just doesn't even consider that as a real possibility. Like, we have the power to save these people. Yes. Let's do it. And Pulaski takes the same basic tack. And when they start circling around for different ways of justifying this, when they start interpreting Sarjanka's radio call as a cry for help, I love Pulaski. She says, "Good enough for me. let's do it." You know, they just have this, you know, fundamental inability to engage in this philosophical debate when people's lives are at stake in the here and now. And this is so Star Trek: The Next Generation. Like, you could have a Romulan warbird hanging off the bow of the Enterprise, and Captain Picard would say, "Let's go to the observation lounge and discuss our options." And I love how calm this is, because we all wish the real world was more like this. When there's a crisis going on, don't you wish someone could just say, "Let's all sit down, we'll have a cup of tea, and we'll sit down and talk about our options and figure out what the right thing to do is." If everyone could just stay calm and drink their tea, the world would be a better place. But sadly, it just doesn't work that way most of the time. But I do think The Next Generation provides a really great model for how these kinds of dilemmas should unfold. Whenever there's a crisis, whenever there's a dilemma, take a deep breath, go to your quarters, drink some tea, we'll talk about it, and then we'll figure out what to do. And while this is going on, the B plot, Wesley's first command, gets invoked, because ultimately Wesley has to realize that when you're in command, it does fall on your shoulders to decide what to do and what not to do, regardless of all the opinions that other people have. When you're sitting in the center seat, it's your decision. And Captain Picard has to face this in this episode. He's heard all the opinions, but ultimately Captain Picard has the say-so. You know, you think he could check in with Starfleet Command. Like, couldn't he use his space ham radio to contact Starfleet and bump it up a level? But no, really, that's not how being a captain works, right? You know, he's out on the frontier, presumably, and he's got to decide. And Wesley gets a lesson in that in his first command. Captain Picard gets reminded of that when he's faced with a moral dilemma in this episode. And I think ultimately, it's an interesting combination of, you know, going slowly and steadily, thinking through your options, but none of that gets you off the hook for making an actual decision. I find the juxtaposition of the various philosophical options that are considered during this debate with Captain Picard's ultimate responsibility for finally making a decision about what to do a really interesting juxtaposition, and summarizes human life. You know, we can think about our options, we can go slow and steadily, but ultimately someone has to decide to act or not act. And none of that gets you off the hook morally, I think, in terms of your responsibility to act or not act and decide what to do or what not to do.
You raised an interesting question, I think, that ties into our recent discussion about the second season of Enterprise. You were talking about, you know, Captain Picard using his space ham radio to call back to headquarters. And A.G. Robinson actually reminds us, he says, "When the first Warp 5 starship's built, Captain won't be able to call home every time he needs to make a decision. He won't be able to turn to the Vulcans unless he decides to take one with him."
Well, you know, it's interesting because while all this is going along, we do get a really interesting discussion about the nature of command and responsibility. And we're all like this. We all serve in a hierarchy. I've got a boss who's got a boss who's got a boss, and you've got a boss who's got a boss who's got a boss. And whatever organization you're in, whatever hierarchy, there's kind of a chain of command, right? And Captain Picard is not the highest level of chain of command, right? He reports to admirals who report to the Federation Council, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't get this sort of pure autonomy. But, you know, he is commander of his starship. And so what's the balance between making a decision in the here and now, using your position in the hierarchy to make a decision based on all the evidence at hand, versus continually going back to your superiors and asking for approval for things, right? Captain Picard could totally have justifiably said, "I don't know what to do in this situation. It's a complex dilemma. I'm going to ask my admirals." It would not have been as interesting of an episode. And and I think, honestly, it might have undercut Captain Picard's credibility as a leader, right? Wesley and Riker have this fascinating discussion about the nature of command and command presence. How come people don't question Captain Picard, right? Why does when he sits down in the center seat or when he gives an order, people don't question it. They just do what he says because he's the captain. Part of that, I think, is being confident in your decisions. Captain Picard has heard all the options. He's got the same rational faculties as his admirals do. He's got all the information. They don't have all the information. So he's the one to make a decision because he's most in the know. And I think wherever your position is in the hierarchy, your job, your role, your career, your whatever, if you're doing the actual work, you have the most information of anyone at hand, right? And I think that confidence in your experience and the information at hand in making a decision can lead to command presence, right? People don't question Captain Picard's ability to make a command decision because they know he's heard all the options and they know that he's going to make a decision that is the best decision given all the information at hand. So they don't question him. Once he's made his decision, that's what people do. And I think having that level of confidence in your decision making, going, okay, I've heard all the information, we've got to get something done, so I'm going to make a decision and make a plan and do it. And if you approach your command decisions in whatever domain you're in that manner, you will have something approaching Captain Picard's command presence. But it's the combination of really listening to all the information at hand, being in the know with all the relevant information, and ultimately recognizing that the responsibility rests on your shoulders. But Captain Picard wouldn't have been a bad captain if he called back to headquarters and asked the admirals what to do, right? Probably that's the right thing to do. He probably should have put the brakes on and said, nope, I'm not qualified to make this decision. It's not my domain. This is a prime directive question. And that's one of those admiral level questions, right? It's above my pay grade. But he would not have been as respected as a leader if he had done that. And I think that tension is really interesting because for any decision you face, you can take one of two approaches. You can go, I'm going to ask my superiors, or I'm going to use my rational faculties with all the information at hand and make a decision. And without fail, most of the time, I think people respect the latter, even though on paper, the former is probably the quote unquote right thing to do.
And I think the thing, Zachary, that really drives this whole thing home, I mean, it really, at the end of the episode, you feel like it was a win in terms of Captain Picard making the right decision, the Enterprise doing the right thing. And that is the fact that in this episode, we meet, and she's the only Dreeman that we meet in the episode, and that is Data's little friend, Sarjanka. She's a young girl. You immediately sympathize. I like the fact that they chose a little girl and not an adult. I think that's really fascinating because immediately
a little Dreaming girl geek with her space ham radio.
Thanks.
That's adorable. I couldn't leave without my transmitter, Data.
In another universe, you two would have been fast friends.
Something like that.
But that's the wild card here. I mean, you cannot, and really it's what it boils down to for Data, certainly, and he's able to really get Picard kind of tipped over the edge with this wild card, and that is Sarjanka, this sympathetic little girl with her space ham radio who's alone down there and she's watching her planet fall apart, quite literally. And at the end of the episode, you feel like it's a win because they save Sarjanka. And on a side note, when we're talking about everybody's position here, I think my favorite character and their position in this entire episode, you know, we talked about Worf, we talked about Pulaski and Riker and Picard and Troy and LaForge, but I think the position that I appreciate the most is O'Brien.
Oh, it's going to be hell to pay?
When Captain Picard walks in and says, "O'Brien, take a nap. You didn't see any of this. You're not involved." He goes, "Yes, sir. I'll be standing over here dozing off until Sarjanka beams aboard, and then he says, "Oh, there's going to be hell to pay."
Well, and that's another fascinating facet of this episode, the banter between Captain Picard and Commander Riker about how in the thick of it they are. You know, they keep going, yes. how much are we in it now? And they go up to here, yes. And they keep using these funny hand motions to indicate, you know, up to our necks, up to our heads here. Mm-hmm. But Captain Picard has to live with that, right? He's made the decision to go this direction, and he's in the thick of it. Really, it's his tail that's on the line with Starfleet Command, right? So he has to kind of take responsibility for the decisions he's made. But real life is like that, right? You make a decision and then the consequences are going to come your way and then you have to take responsibility for those decisions, and he can't backpedal. The damage is already done, essentially. At the end, they kind of cheat a little bit and we'll just wipe her memory and no damage done. I think that actually undercuts the import of the episode in some way. That's insofar as I have criticism of the episode, that's probably my deepest dramatic and maybe philosophical criticism. They can wipe away the consequences at the end of this episode and not really have to live with it. But I do like the the worry that Captain Picard shows about, like, okay, we've decided to let Commander Data keep talking to this person. We've decided to intervene. We're pretty much up in it now. there's no way to backpedal out of this. And, you know, my ass is grass if Starfleet Command doesn't agree. So,
well, those are the stakes that we talked about early in this podcast, Zachary, and all of the humorous banter and even the kind of the humorous little interaction there with O'Brien. In the midst of this, it's easy to forget that the actions that they're taking are actually controversial. And the consequences, honestly, can go beyond the outcome of their intervention. It could actually lead to a court-martial. It could lead to Captain Picard losing his command. It could, you know, there could be other consequences. It could involve other officers. And it's easy to forget that when you're watching this episode, but isn't that life? I think we live in an age where we don't always think about the consequences of our actions. I think it's easy to whip out our smartphone and take a video and, you know, you're going to hand that over to the local news and interpret it any way you want to. And 50% of the people are going to see it your way and 50% of the people aren't. And, you know, at the end of the day, are there any real consequences? And that's just kind of the age that we're living in. And this episode reminds us that in real life, regardless, there are consequences. Things are going to happen. Those results, those consequences, some of them can be positive, some of them can be negative. You can do the right thing and have negative consequences.
Well, you know that Admiral Nora Sati was looking closely into this incident when she was questioning Captain Picard for his loyalty to Starfleet.
And she's taken down bigger men than him, let me tell you.
Very closely into the logs from this time period. So we mentioned the B-plot about Wesley getting his first command, and it's fascinating because I didn't realize these plots were as intimately related as we've made them out to be, and that's a fascinating revelation having seen this episode many different times now. But what do we think of the B-plot and this idea of getting your first command? I mean, everyone has an experience like this, right, where you get that promotion or you're in a position of authority or you have an influence over something. Your first command, whatever that means for you, right? For me, my first command was having my own classroom, going from being a student to being a teacher's assistant to actually running my own classroom, right? Mm-hmm. Going from, you know, TAing, you know, 10 or 15 students to lecturing in a lecture hall with 400 people, my class, right? That was my kind of first command experience. What I found to be true about that is it's amazing how much people's expectations really define who you are. When people expect you to be in a position of authority, like when I walked into that classroom and it was my lecture hall and it was my class for the next 16 weeks, I just became the instructor. It was really a really easy role for me to take on because that's what everyone's expectations were. Any nervousness or uncertainty I had, like Wesley is having here about his first command, very quickly subsided once I realized that it was my class. And if I said, here's what we're doing, that's what everyone did. It was extremely powerful. I felt like Captain Picard, like with the fate of 400 students in my hands, right? But, you know, it was just very easy to fill the role and even given those doubts or worries or whatever. And I think Wesley finds that it's actually really easy too. You know, even though he has a few bumps along the way, when someone says, Wesley, oh man, you should have talked to me first before you decided who goes on this team to do the survey. You know, we really didn't pick the best people. And he's really causing Wesley this crisis of confidence in his own command ability. He's got some older people saying, here's what you need to do. We know more than you do. Even though you're in command, we don't really know what you're doing. So when Wesley finally realizes that all he has to do is say, I've thought about it and I really do want you to do that ISO spectrogram, eventually the people under him are going to go, okay, you're in charge, I'll do it, aye sir. And that's the Starfleet officer's training, and he just has to remind himself that he needs to exert himself with a little command presence. And once he does that, he's like, oh, I've got this, you know, I could be the next Captain Picard. It might actually go to his head. Do you think the next time Captain Picard yells at him, shut up, Wesley, that he will immediately go back into a crisis of confidence?
You shut up.
Yeah, it'll set him back like 5 years. But I think there's something to this that, you know, if you're tentative and wishy-washy, if you go, well, you know, I'd really kind of like it if you guys did blah, 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 and I'm not really sure, but what do you guys think? People aren't going to treat that as authority, right? Ultimately, it's up to Wesley to go, I've thought about it, and I want you to do it because I'm in charge. And he doesn't even have to say that, because once he conveys it in that manner, I would like you to do the isospectrogram. The guy goes, okay, aye, sir. And he walks off and does it. And Wesley kind of beams with pride, like, I made this older dude do what I told him to do, even though he had no reason to listen to me. And you know, and that's the fascinating thing about authority, is sometimes you earn it, sometimes you don't. But if you convey that authority in a if you convey that authority in an authoritative way, how's that for a tautology, right? If you're authoritative with your authority, then, and if you do it nicely, no one likes a jerk, right? If you do it nicely, then people are going to go, okay, you told me to do it, you're in charge, I'll do it. And that, you know, at the end of the day, that's how command goes. And Captain Picard doesn't show that he questions himself. What's fascinating to me about Captain Picard, though, is Captain Picard is deeply insecure in some ways. He does deeply wrestle with moral issues, and he does second guess himself. But he does it in private. He does it with Counselor Troy. But he doesn't show it to his crew, right? He conveys confidence. Even if he's not confident, he'll go back to his ready room and worry, or go back to his quarters and worry. But when he's out on the bridge, he will say, here's what I want everyone to do. I've thought about it. This is my decision. Do it.
Yeah.
And that leads to a great deal of respect from his crew, I think.
Yeah. And from the perspective of someone who has spent a lot of his career in management, I have to say it's one of the things that I really appreciate about Captain Picard, because in reality, Zachary, you do wrestle with the decisions that you make, and you're constantly weighing your options and just trying to calculate what those consequences might be, doing these little line drawing experiments to try and determine what the best course of action is. And sometimes you have to make a decision and you don't have all the information, and you're inside, you're crossing your fingers, and you're hoping to God that you did the right thing, that you made the right decision, that you know, that it's the right call. And it's one of the things that I really appreciate and admire about Captain Picard as a leader, is that he's able to keep those things internal and not project them in front of his staff. And we realize that this is an actor playing a role, but I have to say that you can actually learn a lot about effective leadership by watching the way Captain Picard handles himself here in the Next Generation. I think there's a lot to learn. In fact, one of my favorite little things I like to follow on Twitter are Picard management tips, and some of those actually are, I don't know who runs that, but I have to say some of those are just genius, and I really wish some of my friends in the business world would really tune into those, because again, you can learn a lot about effective leadership from Captain Picard here in the Next Generation.
Well, Captain Picard strikes a really delicate balance. He's open enough with his crew to let them see that he's genuinely thinking through the issue at hand, right? He's listening to their opinions. He's gathering information. He's not overconfident, right? He's not just giving orders for the sake of giving orders. He's really listening to people, and he's really thinking about it. And he lets his crew see that vulnerable side of him. But he doesn't let them see the insecurity, the worry. A little bit sometimes, you know, he over the course of the Next Generation, of course, he becomes better friends with the crew, and he does, you know, let his guard down a little more. But generally, he's kind of a closed book, and he doesn't let them see the inner worry that he has. But after he's listened to everyone, after he's made it, and it's genuine, he's really listening, he's really gathering opinions, he's really gathering information. Once he's made his command decision, he goes into captain mode, right? Here's what we're doing. I've thought about it. This is my decision. Go. And everyone respects that because he took the time to listen to them. They know he's really thinking through the issues at hand. And they, I think, don't worry about the decision because he doesn't show that inner insecurity that really is lurking there. So I think it's a very delicate balance. Unlike, say, Captain Jellicoe, when Captain Jellicoe takes command of the Enterprise, he's not really listening to the people around him. And it shows, right. And they don't really respect him, even though he's not a bad captain. He's making all the right decisions. He's the right person for that situation with the Cardassians in that episode. But he doesn't really listen to his crew, and they don't really respect him for it. And I think Captain Picard, this episode is a great example, because Captain Picard does not agree with everyone's opinion inside that conversation in his quarters, right? There are some opinions there he fundamentally disagrees with. At the end of the day, though, he makes a decision, and even though he's made a decision contrary to the opinions of some of the people in the room, they all respect him for it because they were listened to. They know he's doing his darndest to make the best decision he can in light of all the information at hand, and they fundamentally respect him for it, even though they disagree. And most of us, when someone makes a decision we disagree with, we go, God, what an idiot. I don't really respect that yo-yo. But here, some people in that room have an opinion contrary to the decision Captain Picard makes, and they still respect him for it. And that is a fascinating lesson in respect and leadership.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And that's why when Riker gives Wesley an important little piece of advice, that it carries a lot of weight. I mean, there's real weight to the advice that Riker gives to Wesley. He tells Wesley, in your position, it's important to ask yourself one question. What would Picard do? And that's a great piece of advice, but only for this reason. They've got a great captain who is thoughtful, but when he makes a decision, you know he's weighed the odds, and whatever decision he comes to, you know, you have the confidence to know it's the right one.
I'm actually a little disappointed we didn't get a Wesley boardroom scene. I would love to have seen Wesley sitting at the head of the observation lounge table with his little team around him asking all their opinions. And, you know, then he'll say, okay, thanks everyone for your opinions. Here's what I've decided to do. Go. You know, it would have been fun to see him kind of play Picard a little more.
Yeah. Well, Zachary, I think it's important to highlight that what really makes this episode fascinating is the fact that a piece of random communication saved a civilization.
Well, I think what's interesting about this for me is communication here on Earth is regulated, right? We've got the FCC and we've got international regulatory bodies that adjudicate between countries, and each country sets their own rules within the bounds of what they're allowed to do for their nation. And it's all very orderly and structured, and you need licenses for this, and you get your little slice of bandwidth. And presumably in the future, radio, and by extension, subspace radio, is highly regulated as well. So I'm curious what the rules would be or would not be for being able to turn on your subspace radio or turn on your old-fashioned ham radio like Data does. Again, it's weird. He's like scanning the RF bands. And he's like, I'm going to go all single sideband on everyone here. But what are the rules, right? Who are you allowed to talk to, and who are you not allowed to talk to on subspace, under what conditions, on what frequencies, which governments? Like here on Earth, there are, like, if you're a ham radio operator, there's a small list of people you're not allowed to talk to, right? You know, countries that we don't have an agreement with or whatnot. And, you know, it's interesting, like, what would happen if you got an SOS from a country you're not allowed to talk to? That would be really, that's an interesting dilemma, right? Do you intervene or do you not intervene? Do you break the rules to help save people's lives, or do you not break the rules? That's essentially the dilemma Captain Picard faces. And I can imagine a similar dilemma like that happening here in the real world on the actual ham radio, given the highly regulated situation we live in. So we don't get to see enough of this, of course, in Star Trek, but I'm just curious what the intergalactic subspace regulatory body would say about what's allowed on the subspace bands.
Well, it's interesting because we see little bits of pieces.
Did that sentence come out of my mouth? I'm sorry.
What's that?
I can't believe that sentence came out of my mouth. That's hilarious.
But you know what's fascinating about this is we see these little bits and pieces throughout every iteration of Star Trek where they talk about subspace and other species monitoring subspace, and for that matter, even starships monitoring their subspace frequencies. They know when those subspace calls go out and when they're coming in, and they're monitoring what terminals they're coming from and going out from, and who logged into that terminal. So there's obviously some regulation within the Star Trek universe, but we don't really see it fleshed out very well. But, you know, and maybe that's why Data is over there playing with the, you know, single bands.
I wonder what other
he's going old school, because it's like this clandestine little radio operation he's got. I know they're monitoring subspace, so I'm just gonna play around here with the RF frequencies. And
he said Data doesn't have his license, he's just a subspace listener. like a shortwave listener here in the real world. But I actually kind of wonder what traditions would persist. Like, one of the traditions that I've always liked about ham radio, again, I'm talking about my hobby now, and this is not really related to Star Trek, but I'm going to mention it anyway. One of my favorite things about ham radio is after you talk to someone, it's tradition to send them a little postcard that has the information about the contact on it, like your call sign and your name and location, your address, the frequency the conversation took place on, the date and the time, all this stuff. Then on the back, you can write a little note, and it's like the last little thing someone will remember of you. Like, I know that I've sent these postcards. They're called QSL cards. QSL, I was going into the Q thing. So they're called QSL cards, and I know that somewhere out there on some random ham radio operator's wall, someone's got some of my old QSL cards from when I was 13 or 14 years old. I find that really interesting. It's like this last little memento that someone will remember you by. Even if they'll never see my face, they'll never know anything else about me, but they remember this little contact they had with me 25 years ago. I just find that fascinating. Do you think Data sent a little digital equivalent of a 24th century QSL card to Sarshenka? Do you think she got some random postcard from an android she doesn't remember in the space mail? Subspace mail.
And that's where their ancient aliens theory came.
What the hell is this postcard, Sarshenka? Right. Oh. Lieutenant Commander Data, Starfleet. What the hell? But speaking of QSL cards, before the show, you and I were talking about abbreviations on Morse code and ham radio. And there are these short three-letter abbreviations called Q signals, because they all start with the letter Q. And they're used to convey very complex information. Like I could say QR... hold on. Like I could say QRP question mark in Morse code, and that means, shall I reduce my power? It's a fairly complex sentence all conveyed by three characters to increase the efficiency of communication. But the Q code in ham radio got me thinking about Q in Star Trek. I don't know why. I just think it's funny.
I see Q playing around with dots and dashes on a ham radio.
Like, I can picture Data like, oh, Captain, I've got something to talk with you about. You know, he interrupts his horseback riding. Captain, I've got an important situation. I just received an SOS from Q. He used the Q code.
It's like a special frequency that's
and Captain Picard
reserved.
And Captain Picard's like, but it didn't end there. It never ends there with Q. So how is that related to anything important? It's not. I just think it's interesting.
It's not.
Yeah, that we can laugh about Q when we're talking about Q codes. But I do kind of wonder what traditions would persist. Like, I do think that, I mean, it's people have been predicting the demise of ham radio for decades now, right? Why do people still think this is important? And it's because of things like emergency preparedness, and it's because of things like technological innovation. A great many of the technological achievements that we take for granted had something to do with ham radio along the way, because ham radio operators were the tinkers who were experimenting, and eventually those concepts or those new technological achievements got picked up by companies and governments, and they become the norm. But oftentimes they arose because of ham radio tinkerers, and we forget that fact that, you know, it's hobbyists who came up with a lot of these things. I guess my point is just, I think that will continue. There will always be hobbyists who are innovating that will invent the new thing, and there's a culture around that kind of innovation, and there's a culture around those kinds of hobbies, and they produce things like the Q code, and they produce things like QSL cards, postcards that people hang on the wall, these kinds of social interactions. I'm just curious which kinds of social interactions related to this kind of culture about ham radio and CB and technological achievements, kind of like the internet chat room culture of the 90s too, is kind of related to this. Which parts of our technological culture will persist into the 24th century? I think there will still be a need to contact people you don't know and make new friends, and I think there will still be a need to remember those things after the fact. So something like space ham radio will persist, and something like space QSL cards to remember people by will always persist, I think.
Yeah, I agree completely. I do have to say that I'm really glad that this signal that was sent didn't get warped and displaced in space-time, or else we would have ended up with something that looked a little bit more like the Deep Space Nine episode Sound of Her Voice, which is another great episode that kind of hovers around this idea of communication and the importance of communication and disembodied voices crying out for help. So there's some similarities, but there's also some things about these two episodes that are very different. And I just wanted to get a plug in there for that Deep Space Nine episode. In that episode, the signal that they were using to communicate with this Starfleet officer was displaced in time as it passed through this noxious cloud, and actually was going backward in time. So they were talking to her in the past, and I wonder how this episode might have played had Sarshenka been from the past, and Dream of Four had already been destroyed, and they get there to find out the planet had gone extinct, 2-3 years ago. I just wonder how whole thing would have played
out. That episode would have sucked. That would be so depressing. Like, they get there and Sarshenka's dead.
They have the whole debate, the whole conversation. Wesley's got his first command. Worf's got his arms folded. Pulaski actually turns out to be a good guy. And then it's all for nothing because they get there and Sarshenka's
dead. I can imagine the scene. They get there and they find her bones and maybe like shreds of her clothing or something. And then her like little space ham radio transmitter is still on. And it's like, oh, her transmitter's still on. That's so sad. And then we all cry and then the episode ends. I could imagine that. But that episode of Deep Space Nine that you mentioned, that's a great space ham radio episode too. It's like someone decided to take this idea of the space ham radio and combined it with a causal time loop and squished them together and said, let's make an episode around that. But you know what it really reminds me? It reminds me of that movie Frequency. Have you seen that, where the guy contacts his dad on the, like 30 years in the past? And to me, that movie always resonated with me because my dad's a ham radio operator too. And it's like, oh, that would be cool to be able to talk to my dad 30 years ago on the ham radio, or 50 years ago on the ham radio now. I can't believe it's 50 years. But I think that episode of Deep Space Nine is nowhere near as great of a father-son movie as Frequency.
Frequency probably did
that one a little better, honestly.
For sure. But the kind of the takeaway from the episode at the end of that episode, Zachary, they're all kind of standing around. They're sort of having an impromptu memorial for this fallen Starfleet officer, which all of them had spent some time talking to and had gotten to know a little bit, even though she was from their past. And when they got there, they found that she was already deceased. They had all gotten to know her. They had all kind of forged a bond with her. And it reminded them of, in the midst of this wartime situation that they were in, how important relationships are and communication. And O'Brien kind of said it best. He basically said, I've been pushing people out of my life, and I want to stop that. I need people to connect to and to be a part of my life. It's not a direct quote, of course, but that's the gist of what he's saying. And both of these episodes remind us how vitally important it is that we communicate, that we get to know one another. We live in an age of communication, and yet we are so disconnected as a society. And I love the kind of the moral of both of these stories and how communication really changes things.
Well, as you were describing the situation in that episode of Deep Space Nine, they get there and they realize that the other captain is dead, and there was a time delay or a time differential and whatnot. Mm-hmm. It reminds me, I mentioned the QSL cards. I actually have a fairly large collection of QSL cards that I've collected from ham radio operators over the years.
What's the most unique or most interesting one that you've received?
I received one that was hand-drawn. I think that's really neat. It's a little piece of art. I have one from a guy who worked, I don't even know exactly what he did. I should look him up. He did something with the Apollo moon landings. I remember that vividly. My dad actually talked to King Hussein of Jordan, who was a ham radio operator that once.
A Star Trek fan and made an appearance.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Star Trek, yes.
So, but I guess my point was just that some of these people are dead. I know it. Like, I was 13, like 25 years ago when I was 13, I talked to these people. And I got QSL cards from people who are like in their 80s or 90s, old ham radio operators 25 years ago. And they're dead, right? It's kind of like what happens in this episode, where they show up and this woman's dead. But the conversation meant something. And they have a little memorial. And they will always remember. And it's not going to be an important deep part of their lives, right? They're going to go back to Deep Space Nine and do what they need to do. issue and it's not going to become a major factor. But it's this little thread of memory, like, remember that conversation we had with this person? It really did mean something. And I kind of feel that way to all the now deceased ham radio operators that I talked to over the years, right? We had a meaningful conversation about something either inconsequential or something interesting, like the Apollo landings or whatever it was, what we do for a living, what our philosophical thoughts were. And I've had philosophical discussions over ham radio, just like we're doing here on Metatrex. And I find that really interesting. But some of those people are dead, and I remember them. My grandmother was a ham radio operator too. Like I mentioned that along with my dad, and she's deceased. In fact, they call dead ham radio operators? They call them silent keys, like key, like Morse code key. They call them silent keys. It's such a romantic notion, right? Their signals are, I mean, in some cases, their radio signals are still propagating out into the universe, right? Literally space ham radio. But they're silent keys. They're not with us anymore. But, you know, they're the connection that people share over the radio or any other communications medium is meaningful and it matters. And Pulaski makes this point in the conversation in Captain Picard's quarters. She says, Data's friend is going to die and that means something. And I just think it's a fact of human nature that these conversations, whether they're inconsequential or brief, mean something and they matter. And when people die, there's a loss there. And, you know, I feel that. I don't feel it deeply because I didn't know these people really well, but it does matter to me. And I do remember these people. And I think it's interesting that they'll be remembered long after they're gone because I took the time to talk to them for an hour, you know, on my ham radio when I was 14. I just think that's an interesting notion and it speaks to the meaningfulness of human interaction. And that's something that Pulaski points out in the conversation at Picard's quarters. So, Mike, as we're wrapping up, the one thing I forgot to mention is that back in the day, before there was an internet and before there were podcast networks, there were these things called nets on the ham radio. And they still exist, but nets are basically a group of ham radio operators that meet together on a certain frequency at a certain time to talk about their shared interests. And there were nets for all kind of stuff. And back in the day, there were actually Star Trek nets, too, for people to could talk about Star Trek over the ham radio because there was no other way to find Star Trek. There wasn't an internet. If you wanted to talk with other people who were Star Trek fans and had similar interests, you had to be creative. And if you were ham radio operators and you like Star Trek and there were other ham radio operators and they like Star Trek, then you would start a Star Trek net and you could talk about Star Trek on the ham radio. It was kind of like little proto podcast networks on the ham radio. And now, of course, we have the internet. Now we have podcast networks. We have the Babel Conference, our listeners only discussion group where we can talk about Star Trek and philosophy and all of our common interests. But back in the day, we didn't have those tools. So if you were a ham radio operator, it really did open up the entire world to find people who had similar interests you did. And you could find Star Trek nets on the ham radio back in the day, too. Proto podcast networks, as I would call them.
That's awesome. It wouldn't surprise me a bit if we didn't have maybe one, maybe two of our Babel Conference friends who maybe were a part of one of those.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. If you're listening to this now and you're part of the Babel Conference and you are a ham radio operator and you were a part of a Star Trek net back in the day, I want to hear from you in the comments.
Yes, please comment under the thread and tell us about it. We want to hear that for sure, for sure. I used to dabble a little bit in calligraphy when I was in high school.
Of course you did.
And college. And I used to have a little card mounted on my wall when I was in college. Just something that I wrote down once. I no longer have that card. It's no longer mounted here at my desk or anything like that. It's imprinted upon my spirit. And that is to say that it is impossible to reach out and touch any surface without leaving a mark. And it's a reminder that when we reach out and we connect with someone else, it's impossible not to leave behind a little piece of yourself, not to leave a mark upon them. I think about the people who have come in and out of my life who have left indelible marks, no matter how brief a time we had the privilege of knowing each other. And again, both of these, you're right, that's an incredibly romantic notion. This idea that these silent keys, and that they're gone, but their signals are propagating out there in space. They're gone, but they're not forgotten. They still exist. You and I, long beyond our demise. We will exist in some form here in digital form through these podcasts, and me through my sermons, and you through your work in philosophy and in the classroom. You've left marks on people, and in ministry I've left marks on people. It's impossible to meander our way through life and not do that.
Well, when Data dies in Nemesis and becomes a silent key with his space ham radio, he will be remembered even though he's gone. He's not really dead as long as his space ham radio signals are propagating throughout the universe.
And Sarzenka and her one memory of those yellow eyes. Staring back at me in the dark.
The eyes. I'll never forget the eyes.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about Space Ham Radio and this episode of The Next Generation Pen Pals, but that isn't the only thing that we've been discussing here on the network. So here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
The inscription of this book is a quotation from David Gerrold, which is something he said to me in an email. and he didn't even remember saying it. I met him recently and showed it to him, and he was like, "Oh, wow, that's a pretty good quote. I didn't know I said that." I'm like, "Oh, yeah, you did." But he said, "The primary philosophy in Star Trek, stripped of everything else, was love one another." I think Jesus might have said something like that once, too.
The Orb.
It's always weird. I mean, say you're watching the original series and, you find out that Dr. McCoy's a real Merle Haggard fan.
Right.
That's really strange.
To the journey!
It's his mirror universe.
Oh, is he good?
Oh, really? Is the mirror universe on Suitor?
Is he like super benevolent and just goes around giving money to people?
He was a member of the Terran Rebellion.
Giving out ice cream and kissing puppies.
Primitive Culture. A look at history and culture through Star Trek.
This episode was actually banned by the BBC for many years. And they always said, I don't know if this is true, not so much because of the kind of allegorical significance of the episode, but because of this single line in it where Data says, he basically says, oh, well, the IRA basically achieved what they wanted in, I think it's 2024,
yeah.
It's coming up.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please, please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party apps. And you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up.
Also known as our Star Trek Net. For you ham radio operators.
And that Star Trek Net is a closed group. But if you click join, one of our admins will let you right on in. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose message to a Trek FM show and select Metatreks. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Zachary, when you're not debating the finer points of the Prime Directive in dots and dashes, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek FM as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's dedicated show to all things Star Trek Voyager, along with my two co-hosts over there, Kay Shaw and Suzanne Williamson. You can find me on Twitter if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Frueling. And you can always find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. Well, Mike, when you're not signing off on these podcasts wishing everyone a hearty 73 or best wishes in Morse code, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can always find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. certainly around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm also occasionally on Instagram, cmichael1701. And if you'd like to read my blog about my journey to publish my novel and a little bit about life, you can catch me over at cmichael1701.wordpress.com. Well, Zachary, we want to let our listeners know if they'd like to help us keep all our shows coming each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. There are many, many perks, including early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month, so we really appreciate any support that you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We'd like to take a moment today to acknowledge the rest of the Metatreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Patreon manager Brandon Shea Mutala. We'd also like to give a special shout-out to our two associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can catch Patrick on Twitter at MagicDrop5 is his handle. And your co-host over on To The Journey, Kay Shaw, her Twitter handle is at ChocoWeeble.
Well, Mike, since we're talking about radio in this episode of Metatreks, I think you should do an old-fashioned word from our sponsors.
And here is a word from our sponsors. Don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
That was pretty good, Mike, but I'm a little disappointed you didn't give it a jingle. try that again, but with a little ditty.
Don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space.
Join us at audible.com.
Audible.com. Oh, man. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
Also known as the Star Trek and Philosophy Comedy Hour, apparently.